risk losing this deal just because of something that happened to me. The best case scenario is that I would have been given a severance package to keep my mouth shut. So nobody knows? You do, she says. Eliza looks at me. What if I can't love the baby? What if every time I look at her, I see what happened? Maybe you should get DNA testing, I tell her. What good would it do? Well, I say, you'd know. She shakes her head. And then what? It is a good question. One that I feel all the way to my own core. Is it better not knowing the ugly truth and pretending it doesn't exist? Or is it better to confront it, even though that knowledge may be a weight you carry around forever? I'm about to give her my opinion when Eliza is seized by another contraction. Suddenly, we are both in the trenches again, fighting for a life. It takes 3 hours, and then Eliza pushes her daughter into the world. Eliza starts crying, like many new mothers do, but I know it's not for the same reasons. The OB hands the newborn to me, and I stare down into the angry ocean of that baby's eyes. It doesn't matter how she was conceived. It just matters that she made it here. Eliza, I say, settling the baby on her chest. Here's your daughter. Even as George reaches over his wife's shoulders to stroke the newborn's mottled thigh, Eliza won't look at the baby. I lift the baby up, hold her closer to Eliza's face. Eliza, I say more firmly, your daughter. She drags her gaze toward the baby in my hands. Sees what I see, the blue eyes of her husband, the identical nose, the cleft that matches the one in his chin. This baby might as well be a tiny clone of George. All the tension fades from Eliza's shoulders. Her arms close around her daughter, holding the child so close there's no room for but what if. Hello, baby, she whispers. This family, they'll make their own reality. I just wish it were that easy for the rest of us. By 9 the next morning, it feels like the entirety of New Haven has come to the hospital to give birth. I have been mainlining coffee, running back and forth among 3 postpartum patients, and praying fervently in between that we don't get another woman in active labor before I leave here at 11. In addition to Eliza's delivery, I had 2 more patients last night, a G3 P3 who, truth be told, could have had that baby on her own and nearly did. A G4 P1 who had an emergency C-section. Her baby, only 27 weeks, is in the NICU. When Corinne comes on duty at 7, I'm in the OR with the emergency C-section, so we don't cross paths until it's 9 a.m., and I'm in the nursery. I heard you pulled a double, she said, wheeling a bassinet into the room. What are you doing in here? The nursery used to be where the babies were kept while mothers got a decent night's sleep before they stayed 24/7 in their mother's hospital rooms. So now it's used for mostly storage and for routine procedures like circumcisions, which no parent wants to watch. Hiding, I tell Corinne, pulling a granola bar out of my pocket and devouring it in 2 bites. She laughs. What the hell is going on today? Did I miss the memo for the apocalypse or something? Tell me about it. I glance at the infant for the first time and feel a shudder run down my spine. Baby boy Bauer, the card on the bassinet reads. Without even meaning to, I take a step backward. How's he doing? I asked. Is he eating any better? His sugar's up, but he's still logy, Corinne answers. He hasn't nursed for the past 2 hours because Atkins is going to do the circ. As if Corinne has conjured the pediatrician, Dr. Atkins comes into the nursery. Right on schedule, she says, seeing the bassinet. The anesthesia's had enough time to kick in, and I've already talked to the parents. Ruth, did you give the baby sweeties? Sweeties are a little bit of sugar water rubbed on the baby's gums to soothe and distract them from the discomfort. I would have given the baby sweeties before a circ if I were his nurse. I'm not taking care of this patient anymore, I say stiffly. Dr. Atkins raises a brow and opens the patient file. I see the post-it note, and as she reads it, an uncomfortable silence swells, sucking up all the air in the room. Corinne clears her throat. I gave him sweeties about 5 minutes ago. Great, Dr. Atkins says. Then let's get started. I stand for a moment, watching as Corinne unwraps the baby and prepares him for this routine procedure. Dr. Atkins turns to me. There's sympathy in her eyes, and it's the last thing I want to see. I don't need pity just because of a stupid decision Marie made. I don't need pity because of the color of my skin. So I make a joke of it. Maybe while you're at it, I suggest, you can sterilize him. There are few things scarier than a stat C-section. The air becomes electric once the doctor makes that call, and the conversation becomes parsed and vital. I've got the IV. Can you get the bed? Someone grab the med box and book the case. You tell the patient that something is wrong and that we have to move fast. A page gets sent from the hospital operator to anyone on the team who's outside the building, while you and the charge nurse take the patient to the OR. While the charge nurse rips the instruments from their sterilized paper bag and turns on the anesthesia equipment, you get the patient onto the table, prep the belly, get the drapes up and ready. The minute the doctor and the anesthesiologist run through the door, the cut is made, the baby's out. It takes less than 20 minutes. At big hospitals, like Yale New Haven, they can do it in 7. 20 minutes after Davis Bauer has his circumcision, another of Corinne's patients has her water break. A loop of umbilical cord spools out between her legs, and Corinne is paged from the nursery. An emergency. Monitor the baby for me, she says, as she rushes into the woman's room. A moment later, I see Marie at the head of the patient's bed, wheeling it with an orderly into the elevator. Corinne is crouched on the bed between the patient's legs, her gloved hand in the shadows, trying to keep the umbilical cord inside. Monitor the baby for me. She means that she wants me to watch over Davis Bauer. It is protocol that a circumcised baby has to be checked routinely to make sure that he's not bleeding. With both Marie and Corinne in the thick of a stat C-section, there is literally no one else to do it. I step into the nursery, where Davis is sleeping off the morning trauma. It will only be 20 minutes until Corinne comes back, I tell myself, or until Marie relieves me. I fold my arms and stare down at the newborn. Babies are such blank slates. They don't come into this world with the assumptions their parents have made, or the promises their church will give, or the ability to sort people into groups they like and don't like. They don't come into this world with anything, really, except a need for comfort, and they will take it from anyone without judging the giver. I wonder how long it takes before the polish given by nature gets worn off by nurture. When I look down at the bassinet again, Davis Bauer has stopped breathing. I lean closer, certain that I'm just missing the rise and fall of his tiny chest. But from this angle, I can see how his skin is tinged blue. I immediately reach for him, pressing my stethoscope against his heart, tapping his heels, unwrapping his swaddling blanket. Lots of babies have sleep apnea, but if you move them around a bit, change the position from the back to the belly or the side, respiration begins again automatically. Then my head catches up to my hands. No African-American personnel to care for this patient. Glancing over my shoulder at the door of the nursery, I angle my body so that if someone were to come inside, they'd only see my back. They wouldn't see what I'm doing. Is stimulating the baby the same as resuscitating him? Is touching the baby technically caring for him? Could I lose my job over this? Does it matter if I'm splitting hairs? Does anything matter if this baby starts breathing again? My thoughts whip quickly into a hurricane. It has to be a respiratory arrest. Newborns never have cardiac events. A baby might not breathe for 3 to 4 minutes and still have a heart rate of 100 because its normal heart rate is 150, which means even if blood isn't reaching the brain, it's perfusing the rest of the body, and as soon as you can get the baby oxygenated, the heart rate will come up. For this reason, it's less important to do chest compressions on an infant than to breathe for them. In this, it's the opposite of the way you'd care for an adult patient. But even when I shove aside my doubts and try everything short of medical interaction, he doesn't resume breathing. Normally, I'd grab a pulse ox probe to get a monitor on his oxygenation and heart rate. I'd find an oxygen mask. I'd make calls. What am I supposed to do? What am I not supposed to do? Any moment now, Corinne or Marie might walk into the nursery. They see me interfering with this infant, and then what? Sweat runs down my spine as I hastily wrap the baby up in his swaddling blanket again. I stare at his tiny body. My pulse throbs in my eardrums, a metronome, a failure. I'm not sure if 3 minutes have passed or only 30 seconds when I hear Marie's voice behind me. Ruth, she says, what are you doing? Nothing, I respond, paralyzed. I'm doing nothing. She looks over my shoulder, sees the blue skin of the baby's cheek, and for a hot beat meets my gaze. Get me an ambu-bag, Marie orders. She unwraps the baby, taps his little feet, turns him over, does exactly what I did. Marie fits the pediatric face mask over Davis's nose and mouth and starts to squeeze the bag, inflating his lungs. Call the code! I follow her order. Dial 1500 into the nursery phone. Code blue in the neonatal nursery, I say, and imagine the team being pulled from their regular jobs in the hospital. An anesthesiologist, an intensive care nurse, a recording nurse, a nursing assistant from a different floor, and Dr. Atkins, the pediatrician who saw this baby only minutes ago. Start compressions, Marie tells me. This time I don't waver. With two fingers, I push down on the baby's chest, 200 compressions per minute. As the crash cart is jostled into the nursery, I reach with my spare hand for the leads and affix the electrodes to the baby so that we can see the results of my efforts on the cardiac monitor. Suddenly the tiny nursery is jammed with people, all jockeying for a spot in front of a patient who is only 19 inches long. I'm trying to intubate here, the anesthesiologist yells at an ICU nurse who's attempting to find a scalp vein. Well, I can't get an antecubital line, she argues. I'm in, the anesthesiologist said, and he falls back to let the nurse have better access. She prods, and I push harder with my fingers, hoping to make a vein, any vein, stand out in stark relief. The anesthesiologist stares at the monitor. Stop compressions, he calls, and I raise my hands like I've been caught in the middle of a crime. We all look at the screen, but the baby's rhythm is 80. Compressions aren't effective, he says, so I press down harder on the rib cage. It's such a fine line. There are no abdominal muscles protecting the organs beneath that little pouch of a belly. Bear down a bit too much or a tad off-center and I might rupture the infant's liver. The baby isn't pinking, Marie says. Is the oxygen even on? Can someone get blood gases? The anesthesiologist asks, his question tangling with hers over the baby's body. The ICU nurse reaches into the baby's groin for a pulse, trying to stick the femoral artery for a blood sample to see if the baby's acidotic. A runner, another member of the code team, rushes the vial off to the lab. But by the time we get the results in a half hour, it won't matter. By then, this baby will be breathing again. Or he won't. Damn it, why don't we have a line yet? You want to try? The ICU nurse says. Be my guest. Stop compressions, the anesthesiologist orders, and I do. The heart rate on the monitor reads 90. Get me some atropine. A syringe is handed to the doctor, who pulls off the tip, removes the ambu bag, and squirts the drug down the tube into the baby's lungs. Then he continues to bag, pushing the oxygen and the atropine through the bronchi, the mucous membranes. In the middle of a crisis, time is viscous. You swim through it so slowly you cannot tell if you are living or reliving each awful moment. You can see your hands doing the work, ministering as if they do not belong to you. You hear voices climbing a ladder of panic, and it all becomes one deafening, discordant note. What about cannulating the umbilicus? The ICU nurse asks. It's been too long since birth, Marie replies. This is going downhill fast. Instinctively, I press harder. You're being too aggressive, the anesthesiologist tells me. Lighten up. But what breaks my rhythm is the scream. Brittany Bauer has entered the room and is wailing. She is being held back by the recording nurse as she fights to get closer to the baby. Her husband, immobile, stunned, stares at my fingers pushing against his son's chest. What's happening to him? Brittany cries. I don't know who let them in here. But then again, there was nobody available to keep them out. Labor and delivery has been overworked and understaffed since last night. Corinne is still in the OR with her stat C-section, and Marie is here with me. The Bowers would have heard the emergency calls. They would have seen medical personnel rushing toward the nursery, where their newborn was supposed to be sleeping off the anesthesia from a routine procedure.
I would have run there too.
The door flies open, and Dr. Atkins, the pediatrician, immediately shoves her way to the head of the bassinet. What's going on? There is no answer, and I realize I'm the one who's supposed to reply. I was here with the baby, I say, my syllables accented in rhythm to the compression I'm still doing. His color was ashen, and respirations had ceased. We stimulated him, but there was no gasping or spontaneous breath, so we began CPR. How long have you been at it? Dr. Atkins asks. 15 minutes. Okay, Ruth, please stop for a sec. Dr. Atkins looks at the cardiac monitor. The heart rate now is 40. Tombstones, Marie murmurs. It's the term we use when we see wide QRS complexes on the cardiogram. The right side of the heart is responding too slowly to the left side of the heart. There's no cardiac output. There's no hope. A few seconds later, the heartbeat stops completely. I'm calling it, Dr. Atkins says. She takes a deep breath. This is never easy, but it's even worse when it's a newborn. And she tugs the ambu bag off the tube and tosses it in the trash. Time? We all look up at the clock. No! Brittany gasps, falling to her knees. Please don't stop! Please don't give up! I'm so sorry, Mrs. Bauer, the pediatrician says. But there's nothing we can do for your son. He's gone. Turk wrenches away from his wife and grabs the ambu out of the trash. He shoves the anesthesiologist out of the way and tries to affix it to Davis's breathing tube. Show me how, he begs. I'll take over. You don't have to quit. Please, I can get him to breathe. I know I can. Dr. Atkins puts her hand on his shoulder, and Turk collapses into himself, an implosion of grief. There is no way you can bring Davis back, she says. And he covers his face and starts to sob. Time, Dr. Atkins repeats. Part of the protocol of death is that everyone in the room consents to the moment it occurs. 10:04, Marie says, and we all murmur a somber chorus. I agree. I step back, staring at my hands. My fingers are cramped from performing the compressions. My own heart hurts. Marie takes the baby's temperature, a cool 95. By now, Turk is anchored to his wife's side, holding her upright. Their faces are blank, numb with disbelief. Dr. Atkins is talking softly to them, trying to explain the impossible. Corinne walks into the nursery. Ruth, what the hell happened? Marie tucks Davis's blanket tight around him and slips the little stocking cap back on his head. The only evidence of trauma he suffered is a small tube, like a little straw coming out of his pursed mouth. She cradles the baby in her arms, as if tenderness still counts. She hands him to his mother. Excuse me, I say to Corinne, when maybe what I really mean is, forgive me. I push past her and skirt the grieving parents and the dead baby and barely make it to the restroom before I am violently ill. I press my forehead to the cool porcelain lip of the toilet and close my eyes, and even then I can feel it. The give of the rippled rib cage under my fingers, the whoosh of his blood in my own ears, the acid truth on my tongue. Had I not hesitated, that baby might still be alive. I had a patient once, a teenage girl whose baby was born dead due to class 3 placental abruption. The placenta had peeled away from the uterine lining, and the baby had no oxygen. The severity of the bleeding meant we almost lost the mother as well as the newborn. The baby was sent to our morgue pending autopsy, which is automatic in Connecticut for the death of a neonate. 12 hours later, the girl's grandmother arrived from Ohio. She wanted to hold her great-grandchild just once. I went down to the morgue where the dead babies are kept in an ordinary Amana refrigerator, stacked on the shelves in tiny body bags. I took the baby out and slipped him from the bag, stared for a minute at his perfect little features. He looked like a doll. He looked like he was sleeping. I just couldn't find it in myself to hand this woman an ice-cold baby. So I wrapped him up again and went to the emergency room for some heated blankets. In the morgue, I swaddled the baby in them one after another, trying to take the chill from his skin. I took one of the knit caps we usually put on newborns to cover the peak of his head, mottled purple with settled blood. We have a policy. If a newborn dies, we never take him away from the mother. If that grieving woman wants to hold her baby for 24 hours, to sleep with him tucked against her heart, to brush his hair and bathe him, and have all the moments with her child she will never get to have, we make it happen. We wait until the mother is ready to let go. That grandmother held her great-grandson for an entire afternoon. Then she put the infant back into my arms. I put a towel over my shoulder, as if I were nursing him, and got into the elevator, taking him down to the basement level of the hospital, where our morgue is located. You'd think that the hardest part of an experience like this is the moment when the mother gives you her child, but it's not. Because at that moment, it's still a child to her. The hardest part is taking off the little knit hat, the swaddling blanket, the diaper, zipping him into the body bag, closing the refrigerator door. An hour later, I am in the staff room, taking my coat from the locker when Marie pokes her head inside. You're still here? Good. Got a minute? I nod, sitting down across from her at the table. Someone has tossed a handful of hard candy on it. I take a piece and unwrap it, let the butterscotch bleed onto my tongue. I hope it will keep me from saying what I shouldn't say. What a morning, Marie sighs. What a night, I answer. That's right, you pulled a double. She shakes her head. That poor family. It's horrible. I may not agree with their beliefs, but that doesn't mean I think they deserve to lose a baby. We had to sedate the mom, Marie tells me. The baby's gone downstairs. Wisely, she does not mention the father to me. Marie flattens a form on the table. This is obviously just protocol. I need to write up what officially happened when Davis Bauer went into respiratory at rest. You were in the nursery? I was covering for Corinne, I reply. My voice is steady, soft, even though every syllable feels as dangerous as a blade at my throat. She got called to the OR unexpectedly. The Bauer baby had his circ at 9 and couldn't be left unattended. Since you were at the StatC too, I was the only body even available to stand in for observation. Marie's pen scratches across the form. None of this is anything she doesn't know or expect. When did you notice that the infant had stopped breathing? I curled my tongue around the candy, tucked it high in my cheek. A moment before you arrived, I say. Marie starts to speak and then bites her lip. She taps the pen twice, then puts it down with a definitive click. A moment, she repeats, as if she's weighing the scope and size of that word. Ruth, when I came in, you were just standing there. I was doing what I was supposed to do, I correct. I wasn't touching that baby. I get up from the table, buttoning my coat, hoping she cannot see that my hands are shaking. Is there anything else? It's been a tough day, Marie says. Get some rest. I nod and leave the break room. Instead of taking the elevator to street level, though, I plunge to the bowels of the hospital, in the overexposed fluorescent fixtures of the morgue. I blink, letting my eyes adjust, wondering why Clarity is always so damn white. He's the only dead baby there. His limbs are still pliable. His skin hasn't taken on a chill. There's mottling in his cheeks and feet. But that is the only clue that he is anything other than what he seems to be at first glance. Someone's beloved. I lean against a steel gurney, cradling him in my arms. I hold him the way I would have if I'd been allowed to. I whisper his name and pray for his soul. I welcome him into this broken world, and in the same breath, say goodbye.
Kennedy. It's been quite the morning. First, we all overslept because I thought Micah had set his alarm and he thought I had set my alarm. Then our 4-year-old Violet refused to eat a bowl of Cheerios and sobbed until Micah agreed to fry an egg for her. At which point, she was so far gone down the path of nuclear meltdown that she burst into tears again when the plate was set down.
I want a fucking knife!
She screamed. And it was quite possibly the only thing that could have stopped both Micah and me in our frenetic tracks.
Did she just say what I think she said?
Micah asked. Violet wailed again, this time more clearly.
I want a fork and knife!
I burst out laughing, which made Micah give me a withering look.
How many times have I told you to stop swearing?
He says.
You think it's funny that our 4-year-old sounds like a sailor?
Technically, she wasn't. Technically, you misheard it.
Don't lawyer me,
Micah muttered. Don't lecture me, I said. So by the time we left, Micah taking Violet to preschool before he went to perform 6 back-to-back surgeries, me driving in the opposite direction to my office, the only family member in a good mood was Violet, who had breakfast with all her utensils and was wearing her fancy sequined Mary Janes, because neither of her parents had the energy to fight her about that, too. An hour later, my day has gone from bad to worse, because although I went to law school at Columbia, graduated in the top 5% of my class, spent 3 years clerking for a federal judge, today, my boss, the head of the New Haven Judicial District of the Division of Public Defenders Services in the state of Connecticut, has sent me to negotiate about bras. Warden Al Wozewicz, the director of corrections at the New Haven facility, is sitting in a stuffy conference room with me, his deputy director, and a lawyer from the private sector, Arthur Wang. I'm the only woman in the room, mind you. This convening of what I've come to call the itty-bitty-titty committee has been precipitated by the fact that 2 months ago, female lawyers were barred from entering the prison if we were wearing underwire bras. We kept setting off the metal detectors. The prison wouldn't settle for a pat-down, insisting on a strip search, which was illegal and time-consuming. Ever resourceful, we started going into the ladies' room and leaving our underwear there, so that we could go in and visit our clients. But then the prison said we couldn't go inside braless. Al rubs his temples.
Ms. McQuarrie, you have to understand, this is just about minimizing risk.
Warden, I reply, they let you go inside with keys. What do you think I'm going to do? Bust someone out of jail with a foundation garment? The deputy warden cannot meet my gaze. He clears his throat.
I went to Target and looked at the bras they have for sale there.
My eyebrows shoot up to my hairline, and I turn to Al. You sent him to do field research? Before he can answer, Arthur leans back in his chair.
You know, it does beg the question of whether the entire clothing policy should be under review,
he muses.
Last year I was trying to see a client last minute before I headed out for vacation. I was wearing sandals and was told I couldn't enter the prison with them. But the only other shoes I had were golf cleats, which were perfectly acceptable.
Cleats, I repeat. The shoes with actual spikes on the bottom? Why would you send someone in with cleats but not flip-flops? The warden and the deputy exchange a glance.
Well, because of the toe lickers,
says the deputy. You're afraid that someone is going to suck our toes?
Yes,
the deputy says, deadpan.
Trust me, it's for your own protection. It's like a conjugal visit with your foot.
For just a heartbeat, I picture the life I could have had if I'd joined a sterile corporate law firm on the partner track. I imagine meeting my clients in paneled wood conference rooms instead of repurposed storage closets that smell like bleach and pee. I imagine shaking the hand of a client whose hand isn't trembling from meth withdrawal, or abject terror at a justice system he doesn't trust. But there are always trade-offs. When I met Micah, he was a fellow in ophthalmology at Yale New Haven. He examined me and said I had the most beautiful colobomas he'd ever seen. On our first date, I told him I really did believe justice was blind, and he said that was only because he hadn't had a chance to operate yet. If I hadn't married Micah, I would have probably followed the rest of the law review staff to sleek chrome offices in big cities. Instead, he went into practice, and I stopped clerking to give birth to Violet. When I was ready to go back to work, Micah was the one who reminded me of the sort of law I used to champion. Thanks to his salary, I was able to practice it.
"I'll make the money," Micah used to tell me. "You make the difference."
As a public defender, I was never going to get rich, but I'd be able to look myself in the mirror. And since we live in a country where justice is supposed to be meted out equally, no matter how much money you have or what age you are or what your race or gender or ethnicity is, shouldn't public defenders be just as smart and aggressive and creative as any attorney for hire? So I flatten my hands on the table. "You know, Warden, I don't play golf, but I do wear a bra. And you know who else does? My friend Harriet Strong, who's a staff attorney for the ACLU. We went to law school together, and we try to have lunch once a month. I think she'd be fascinated to hear about this meeting, considering Connecticut prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And given that only female lawyers or those lawyers identifying as female would even be wearing bras when visiting clients in this facility. Which means that your policy is infringing on attorneys' rights and is preventing us from providing counsel. I'm also pretty sure Harriet would love to talk to the Women's Bar Association of Connecticut to see how many other female lawyers have complained. In other words, this falls smack into the category of, you are fucked if this gets out in the press. So, the next time I come to see a client, I am going to take my 34C Le Mystère demi-cup with me, and pardon the metaphor, I am going to assume there will not be any fallout. Would I be assuming correctly? The warden's mouth tightens.
I'm confident we can revisit the underwire ban.
Good, I say, gathering my briefcase. Thanks for your time, but I have to get to court. I sail out of the little room, Arthur at my heels. As soon as we are outside the prison, in the blinding sunlight, he grins.
Remind me not to wind up opposite you in court.
I shake my head. Do you really play golf?
I do when it means sucking up to a judge, he says. Are you really a 34C?
You'll never know, Arthur. I laugh. And we head to our separate cars in the parking lot, off to minister to two very different worlds. My husband and I do not sext. Instead, our phone conversations consist of a roll call of nationalities. Vietnamese, Ethiopian, Mexican, Greek. As in, where should we get takeout from tonight? But when I get out of my meeting at the jail, there is a message waiting for me from Micah.
Sorry I was an asshole this morning.
I grin and text him back. No wonder our kid curses.
Date tonight?
Micah writes. My thumbs fly over my phone. You had me at asshole, I type. Indian?
I vinda look forward to it,
Micah responds. See, this is why I can't ever stay mad at him. My mother, who grew up in North Carolina on the debutante circuit, believes there is nothing a little cuticle softener and eye cream can't fix. To this end, she is always trying to get me to take care of myself, which is code for try to make an effort to look nice, which is completely ridiculous. Given that I have a small child and about 100 needy clients at any given moment, all of whom deserve my time more than the hairdresser who could put highlights in my hair. Last year, for my birthday, my mother gave me a gift I have consciously avoided until today. A gift certificate to a day spa for a 90-minute massage. I can do a lot in 90 minutes. File one or two briefs, argue a motion, make and feed Violet breakfast, even, if I'm going to be honest, squeeze in a rollicking romp in the sheets with Micah. If I have 90 minutes, the last thing I want to do is spend it naked on a table while some stranger rubs oil all over me. But, as my mother points out, it's expiring in a week, and I haven't used it yet. So, because she knows I'm too busy to take care of details like this, she has taken the liberty of booking me into Spot On, a day spa catering to the busy professional woman. Or so it says on the logo. I sit in the waiting room until I am called, wondering if they really thought that name through. Spot On? Or Spat On? Either one sounds unpalatable to me. I stress about whether or not I am supposed to wear panties under my robe, and then struggle to figure out how to open my locker and secure it. Maybe this is the grand plan. Clients are so frustrated by the time they get to the massage that they cannot help but leave in a better state than they started. I'm Clarice, my therapist tells me in a voice as soft as a Tibetan gong. I'm just going to step out while you get comfortable. The room is dark, lit with candles. There is some insipid music playing. I shrug off my robe and slippers and climb under the sheet, fitting my face into the little hole in the massage table. A few moments later, there is a soft knock. Are we ready? I don't know. Are we? Now, you just relax, Clarice says. I try. I mean, I really do. I close my eyes for about 30 seconds. Then I blink them open and stare at her feet in their sensible sneakers through the face hole of the massage table. Her firm hands begin to run the length of my spine. Have you worked here a long time? I ask. 3 years. I bet there are some clients you walk in and see and wish you didn't have to touch. I muse. I mean, like back hair? Ugh. She doesn't answer. Her feet shift on the floor. I wonder if she's thinking that I'm one of those clients now. Does she really see my body like a doctor would? A slab to be worked upon? Or is she seeing the cellulite in my ass and the roll of fat that I usually hide under my bra strap and thinking that the yoga mom she rubbed down last hour was in much better shape? Clarice, wasn't that the name of the girl from Silence of the Lambs? Fava beans and a nice Chianti, I murmur. I beg your pardon? Sorry, I mutter, my chin mashed into the massage table. Hard to talk in this contraption. I could feel my nose getting stuffy. When I lie face down like this too long, that happens. And then I have to mouth breathe, and I think that the therapist is listening, and sometimes I even drool through the hole. More reasons I don't like massages. Sometimes I think about what would happen if I got into a car crash and was stuck upside down like that, I say. Not in the car, you know, but at the hospital, in one of those neck braces that gets screwed into your skull so that your vertebrae don't shift. What if the doctors flipped me onto my belly and I got congested like I am right now and couldn't tell them? Or what if I was in that kind of coma where you're awake but trapped inside your body and you can't talk and you desperately need to blow your nose? My head is pounding now from being in this position. It doesn't even have to be that complicated. What if I live to 105 and I'm in a rest home and I get a cold and no one thinks to get me a few drops of Afrin? Clarice's feet move away from my range of view, and then I feel cool air on my legs as she begins to massage my left calf. My mother got me this treatment for my birthday, I say. That's nice. She's a big fan of moisturizing. She actually said that it wouldn't kill me not to have dinosaur hide for skin if I wanted my husband to stick around. I pointed out that if lotion was what was keeping my marriage intact, I had a much bigger problem than whether or not I had time to schedule a massage. Ms. McQuarrie, the therapist says, I don't think I've ever had a client who needed a massage quite as much as you do. For some reason, this makes me proud. And at the risk of losing my tip, I also don't think I've ever had a client who was so bad at getting a massage. This makes me even prouder. Thanks, I say. Maybe you could just try to relax. Stop talking. Clear your mind. I close my eyes again and start going over my to-do list in my head. For what it's worth, I murmur. I'm bad at yoga, too. On days when I work late and Micah is still at the hospital, my mother picks Violet up from school. It's a win-win-win. I don't have to pay for a sitter. My mother gets time with her only grandchild, and Violet adores her. No one throws a tea party like my mom, who insists on using her old wedding china and linen napkins and pouring sweet tea from the pot. I know, when I come home, that Violet will have been bathed, read to, and tucked in. There will be leftover lemon drops or oatmeal raisin cookies from the afternoon's tea party, still warm inside a Tupperware. My kitchen will be cleaner than I left it that morning. My mother also drives Micah crazy.
Eva means well, he is fond of saying, but so did Joseph McCarthy.
He says that my mother is a bulldozer dressed as a Southern belle. In a way, this is true. My mother has a way of getting what she wants before you consciously realize you've been played. Hi, I say, dropping my briefcase on the couch as Violet launches herself into my arms.
I finger-painted,
Violet announces, holding her palms up to me. They are still slightly blue.
I couldn't take the picture home yet because it's still wet.
Hey, sugar,
my mother says, coming out of the kitchen.
How was your day?
Her voice always makes me think of heliotrope and a convertible ride and the sun beating on the crown of your head.
Oh, the usual, I tell her.
I didn't have a client try to kill me today, so that was a plus.
Last week, a man I was representing in an aggravated assault charge tried to strangle me at the defense table when the judge set bail unusually high. I'm still not sure if my client was angry or planting a seed for an insanity defense. If it was the latter, I sort of have to give him props for thinking ahead.
Kennedy? Not in front of the CHILD. Vi, honey, can you go get Grandma's purse?
I set Violet on her feet and she sprints into the mudroom.
You know when you say things like that, it makes me want to get a prescription for Xanax.
My mother sighs.
I thought you were going to start looking for a real job when Violet went to school.
A, I do have a real job, and B, you're already taking Xanax, so that's a specious threat.
Must you argue everything?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer. I realize then that my mother is wearing her coat.
Are you cold?
I told you I couldn't stay late tonight. Darla and I are going to that counter dance to meet some silver foxes.
Contra dance, I correct. Number one, ew.
Number two, you never told me.
I did, last week.
You just chose not to listen, sugar.
Violet comes into the room again and hands her her purse.
That's a good girl, she says. Give me a kiss now.
Violet throws her arms around my mother.
But you can't go, I say. I have a date.
Kennedy, you're married. If anyone needs a date, it's me. And Darla and I have big plans for just that.
She sails out the door and I sit down on the couch.
Mommy, Violet says, can we have pizza?
I look at the sequined shoes on her feet.
I've got a better idea, I tell her.
Well,
Micah says when he sees me sitting at the table of the Indian restaurant with Violet, who has never been anywhere fancier than a Chili's.
This is a surprise.
Our babysitter skipped town, I tell him, and I glance sidelong at Violet. And we are skating the thin edge of DEFCON 4, so I already ordered. Violet is coloring on the paper tablecloth.
Daddy,
she announces.
I want pizza.
But you love Indian food, Vi, Micah says.
No, I don't. I want pizza,
she insists. Just then the waiter comes over with our food.
Perfect timing, I murmur. See, honey?
Violet turns her face up to the waiter, her blue eyes wide as she stares at his Sikh turban.
How come he's wearing a towel?
Don't be rude, sweetie, I reply. That's called a turban, and that's what some Indian people wear. She furrows her brow.
But he doesn't look like Pocahontas.
I want the floor to open up and swallow me, but instead, I paste a smile on my face. I'm so sorry, I tell the waiter, who is now unloading our dishes as quickly as he can.
Violet, look, your favorite. Chicken tikka masala.
I spoon some onto her plate, trying to distract her until the waiter goes away.
Oh my God, I whisper to Micah. What if he thinks we're horrible parents? Or horrible people?
Blame Disney.
Maybe I should have said something different.
Micah takes a spoonful of vindaloo and puts it on his plate.
Yeah, he says. You could have picked Italian.
Turk. I'm standing in the middle of the nursery my son is never going to use. My fists are like two anvils at my sides. I want to swing them. I want to punch holes in the plaster. I want the whole fucking room to come tumbling down. Suddenly there's a firm hand on my shoulder. You ready? Francis Mitchum, my father-in-law, stands behind me. This is his duplex. Britt and I live on one side and he lives on the other. Francis crosses the room and yanks down the Peter Rabbit curtains. Then he pours paint into a little tray and begins to roll the walls white again, washing away the pale yellow that Britt and I brushed onto the walls less than a month ago. The first coat doesn't quite cover the paint beneath, so the color peeks through like something trapped under ice. With a deep breath, I lie down under the crib. I lift the Allen wrench and begin to loosen the bolts that I had so carefully tightened, because I didn't want to be the reason anything bad happened to my son. Who knew? There didn't have to be a reason. I left Britt sleeping off a sedative, which was an improvement over the way she was this morning at the hospital. I thought nothing could be worse than the crying that wouldn't stop, the sound of her breaking into pieces. But then, at about 4 a.m., all of that stopped. Britt didn't make a sound. She just stared, blank, at the wall. She wouldn't answer when I called her name. She wouldn't even look at me. The doctors gave her medicine to make her sleep. Sleep, they told me, was the best way for a body to heal. Me? I hadn't slept, not a wink. But I knew it wasn't sleep that was going to make me feel better. That was going to take some wilding, a moment of destruction. I needed to pound out the pain inside me, give it a home someplace else. With one last turn of the wrench, the crib collapses, the heavy mattress landing on my chest. Francis turns at the sound of the crash. You all right there? Yeah, I say, the wind knocked out of me. It hurts, but this is a kind of hurt I understand. I'll have a bruise. It will fade. I slide myself out from the tangle of wood and kick at it with my boot. Probably a piece of crap anyway. Francis frowns. What are you going to do with it? I can't keep it. I know that Britt and I might have another baby one day if we're lucky, but putting this crib back into a nursery would be like making our new child sleep with a ghost. When I don't answer, Francis wipes his hands clean with a rag and begins to gather up the pieces of wood. The Aryan Women's League will take it, he says. Britt had gone to a few of their meetings. They were a bunch of former skin chicks who went to WIC with fake IDs and got baby formula for free, bilking the system to bring formula to women whose men were serving time for fighting for the cause. Francis isn't much to look at now. He runs the drywall crew I work for, has a decent rating on Angie's List, and votes Tea Party. Old skinheads don't die. They used to join the KKK, but now they join the Tea Party. Don't believe me? Go listen to an old Klan speaker and compare it to a speech by a Tea Party patriot. Instead of saying Jew, they now say federal government. Instead of saying fags, they say social ilk of our country. Instead of saying nigger, they say welfare. But in the 80s and 90s, he was a legend. His white alliance army had as much clout as Tom Metzger's white Aryan resistance. Matt Hale's World Church of the Creator, William Luther Pierce's National Alliance, and Richard Butler's Aryan Nations. Back then, he was raising Brit on his own, and his terror squad would roam the streets of New Haven with tack hammers, broken hockey sticks, blackjacks, lead pipes, beating up niggers and faggots and Jews while Brit, still a baby, napped in the car. But when things began to change in the mid-90s, when the government cracked down on skinhead crews, leaders like Francis found themselves strung up by their own brass balls, headed to prison. Francis understood that if you don't want to break, you have to bend. He was the guy who changed the structure of the white power movement from an organization to small cells of friends with common political leanings. He told us to grow our hair out, to go to college, to join the military, to blend in. With my help, he created and ran a website and message board. "We aren't crews anymore," he'd tell me over and over. "We are pockets of discontent within the system." And as it turned out, it was even more terrifying to people to know we walked and lived among them unseen. I think about the Aryan Women's League taking the crib, the changing table that I got at a garage sale and sanded down, the baby clothes that Brit picked through at Goodwill that are folded up in the dresser, the baby powder and shampoo in bottles. I think about some other baby, some live baby, using it. I stand up so fast I get dizzy and find myself staring into a mirror with little balloons painted on its frame. I'd come home from work to find Brit at the table with a brush in her hand, and I teased her about becoming Martha Stewart. She said the only thing she had in common with Martha Stewart was a record, but she was laughing. She painted a balloon on my cheek, and then I kissed her, and for that one moment, holding her in my arms with the unborn baby balanced between us, everything was perfect. Now my eyes are ringed with dark circles. My beard started to grow in. My hair is matted. I look like I'm on the run from something. "Fuck this," I whisper, and I slam out of the nursery into the bathroom. There I find my electric razor. I plug it in and in one clean swoop mow a clear trail down the center of my head. I buzz each side, letting tufts of hair fall on my shoulders and into the sink. Like magic. As the hair falls away, a picture is revealed right on the crown of my head, just above the hairline. A thick, black swastika, with my initials and Brit's forming its knotted center. I'd gotten it when she said yes, she'd marry me. I had been 21 and pretty shit-faced at the time. When I came to show Brit this testament to my love, she didn't even have a chance to comment before Francis walked up and smacked me hard on the back of the head. "Are you as stupid as you look?" he asked. "What part of undercover don't you understand?" "It's my secret," I told him, and I smiled at Brit. "Our secret. When my hair grows in, no one will know it's there but us." "And what if you go bald?" Francis asked. He could tell from the expression on my face that I hadn't thought about that. Francis didn't let me out of his house for the next 2 weeks until all you could see was a dark shadow under my buzz cut that sort of looked like mange. Now I take a straight edge and some shaving cream and finish the job. I run my hand over my smooth head. It feels lighter. I notice the movement of air behind my ears. I walk back into the nursery, which isn't a nursery anymore. The crib is gone, and the rest of the furniture is stacked in the hall. Everything else is in boxes, thanks to Francis. Before Brit is discharged this afternoon, I will haul back in a bed frame and a nightstand, and she will see it as the guest room it was a few months ago. I stare at Francis, daring him to challenge me. His eyes trace the lines of my tattoo, like he is feeling for a scar. "I get it, boy," he says softly. "You're going to war." There's nothing worse than leaving a hospital without the baby you went in to have. Brit's in the wheelchair, hospital protocol, being driven by an orderly, more hospital protocol. I have been relegated to bringing up the rear, a stocking cap pulled low on my forehead. Brit keeps her eyes on her hands, folded in her lap. Is it just me? Or is everyone staring at us? Are they wondering what's the medical issue with the woman who doesn't have a bald head or a cast or anything else visibly wrong? Francis has already pulled the SUV up to the horseshoe driveway of the hospital. A security guard opens the back door as I help Britt out of the chair. I'm surprised by how light she feels, and I wonder if she will just float away from me once her hands stop gripping the arms of the wheelchair. For a moment, pure panic crosses over her face. I realize she's recoiling from the dark cave of the back seat, as if there might be a monster hiding inside. Or a car seat. I slide my arm around her waist. "Baby," I whisper. "It's okay." Her spine stiffens, and she steels herself before ducking into the car. When she realizes that she is not sitting next to an empty baby carrier, every muscle relaxes and Britt leans back against the seat with her eyes closed. I slip into the front seat. Francis catches my eye and raises his brows. "How are you feeling, Ladybug?" he asks, using the term of endearment he used to call her as a child. She doesn't answer. She just shakes her head as one fat tear snakes down her cheek. Francis revs the engine and peels out of the hospital driveway, as if he could outrun everything that happened there. Somewhere in a freezer in the basement is my child. Or maybe by now he's gone, carved open like a Thanksgiving turkey on the coroner's table. I could tell him what happened. I could tell him the horrible thing I see every time I close my eyes. That black bitch beating on my son's chest. She was alone with Davis. I overheard the other nurses talking about it in the hallway. She was alone when she wasn't supposed to be. Who knows what happened when no one was looking? I glance back at Britt. When I look in her eyes, they're empty. What if the worst thing isn't that I've lost my child? What if it's that I've also lost my wife? After high school, I moved to Hartford and got a job at Colts Manufacturing. I took a few classes at the community college there, but the liberal shit those professors dished out made me so sick I quit. I didn't stop hanging around the college, though. My first recruit was a skateboarder, a skinny kid with long hair who cut in front of a black dude in line at the student cafe. The nigger shoved him, and Yorkie shoved him back and said, "If you hate it here so much, go back to Africa." The food fight that ensued was epic, and it ended with me reaching out a hand to Yorkie and pulling him from the fray. "You know," I told him as we stood outside smoking, "you don't have to be the victim." Then I handed him a copy of The Final Call, the Nation of Islam newsletter that I'd planted on bulletin boards all over the campus. "You see this?" I said, starting to walk, knowing he'd follow. "You want to tell me why no one's marching into the black student union and arresting them for hate speech? For that matter, how come there's not a white student union?" Yorkie snorted. "Because," he said, "that would be discrimination." I looked at him as if he was Einstein. "Exactly." After that, it was easy. We'd find the kids who were bullied by jocks and interfere so that they knew they had protectors. We invited them to hang out with us after classes, and as we drove, I'd plug in a playlist of Screwdriver, No Remorse, Berserker, Centurion. White power bands that sounded like a demon growling that made you want to mess with the world. I made them believe they had worth simply because of the color they were born. When they complained about anything on campus, from the registration process to the food, I reminded them that the president of the school was a Jew and that it was all part of a bigger plan by the Zionist occupation government to suppress us. I taught them us meant white. I took their weed and Molly and tossed it in the dumpster because addicts snitched. I made them over in my image. "I've got a great pair of Doc Martens," I told Yorkie. "They're just your size, but there's no way I'm passing them on to a guy with greasy hair and a man bun." The next day, he showed up with his hair neatly trimmed, his scruff shaved. Before long, I'd created my own wilding squad, the newly minted Hartford Division of NADS. I wager I taught the students at that school more than any hotshot professor. I showed them the elemental differences between the races. I proved that if you're not the predator, you're the prey. I wake in a pool of sweat, fighting my way out of a bad dream. Immediately I feel across the covers for Britt, but there's no one there. I swing my legs over the side of the bed and start moving, fighting through the dark like it's a crowd. I might as well be sleepwalking the way I'm drawn to the room that Francis and I worked so hard to repaint before Britt was released from the hospital.